One of the lessons of the book is that geography still matters. Old truths like geography matters and government matters matter even to the internet. And it seems obvious, but if you look at it from one perspective, but it hasn't been obvious to a lot of people.
Jack Goldsmith, professor of law at Harvard, talks about who controls the internet, illusions of a borderless world. A new book co-written with Columbia Law School professor Tim Wu. The book asks the following questions. Is the internet erasing national borders? Will the future of the net be set by internet engineers, rogue programmers, the United Nations, or powerful countries? On this edition of Audio Berkman, we'll hear from Jack Goldsmith speaking at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School. For Audio Berkman, I'm Colin Rinesmith.
It's a real pleasure for me to be at the Berkman Center. I've known about the Berkman Center for a long time, and I've learned a lot from the Berkman Center, especially your reports on internet filtering, which are fascinating and which we rely on and talk about in this book. But I've never actually been here before, and even though it's 100 yards from my office, I'm very happy to be here. I'm a little intimidated to be here because you all know probably a lot more about the internet than I do. I came to this field, I've never taught internet law, and I came to this field through the field of conflict of laws, which is the field that I've taught and written about conflicts for 15 years. It's the field of law that deals with multi-jurisdictional conflict. And so I had been thinking about multi-jurisdictional conflict outside of the internet context. This is situations in which people from different places enter into contracts or have torts or something happens that touches on two or more jurisdictions, and the problem in conflict of laws is how do you sort out which jurisdiction gets to govern? I got into the field when my good friend Larry Lessig sent me an email when I was teaching at the University of Virginia. This was 1995. I literally knew nothing about the internet. Larry knew a lot about computers and was just getting into internet. He hadn't written his first internet article yet. He was just getting interested in it. And he sent me the Johnson & Post article in draft form from the 1996, I think it was, Stanford Law Review. And he said to me, would you read this and tell me what's wrong with it from a conflict of laws perspective? And I'm sure you all know the famous Johnson & Post article, Law and Borders. And so I read it, and it gave me a billion ideas, and I wrote him back a long email. And about 4 hours later, that email had been pasted into, had an introduction and a conclusion and some few things added to it, and Larry sent it back to me, and it was our first article on the internet. And we presented it. It was called something about the virtual magistrate. Remember the old virtual magistrate project 10 years ago? Is that still going? Anyone remember this? This is ancient history. Anyway, so that's how I got into the field, when Larry sort of forced me to read the Johnson & Post stuff and to start thinking about it from a conflicts perspective. And what seemed new to internet scholars 10 years ago, in terms of the internet's ubiquity, its apparent presence in every jurisdiction, and the enormously difficult conflict of laws problems that it appeared to present, didn't seem new to someone who had been thinking about conflicts for a long time, thinking about multi-jurisdictional conflicts, including jurisdictional conflicts involving 50 or 100 jurisdictions. And so I came to this, and this book comes to this, from the perspective of someone who's thinking about this through the lens of how do we resolve multi-jurisdictional conflicts. The book basically makes three claims. Tim came on board. Tim and I actually, just to give you a little more history about the book, I got to know Tim when he was clerking for Dick Posner in Chicago, and I was living in Chicago at the time, teaching at the University of Chicago. We became friends, and we used to meet frequently and just talk about all sorts of things. We have lots of common interests. And it turns out that Tim and I wrote very similar articles at about the same time. When he was a student here, he wrote an article in the Harvard Journal of International Law about that was basically similar in its thesis to an article I wrote called Against Cyber Anarchy, both of us arguing that internet transactions were not really beyond the control of states, that the fact that you could internet transactions came from abroad and couldn't be stopped at the border, internet communications, didn't mean they couldn't be controlled through intermediaries within the state. And pointing out how these problems weren't a whole lot different from ordinary conflict of laws problems. So Tim and I became friends. We eventually decided to write this book together. And it was a terrific process of working with him, and it certainly is a much, much, much better book for his involvement than if I had just done it myself. I hope he thinks the same thing. Okay, the book makes three claims, basically. And let me just say one more thing before I get to the claims. So the book is really a history of the idea that was dominant a decade ago. The idea that the internet was something different in kind that was going to be a novel and basically unstoppable challenge to territorial governments. The idea being that because internet transactions were ubiquitous, because information could be sent and stored offshore in a place where it was legal and sent into a country over its borders to a place where it was illegal, that countries would be helpless, would be impossible to regulate these transactions because you couldn't stop the bits at the border, you couldn't go abroad to stop the source of the content, and once it got in your country, there's basically it was useless or helpless to do anything about it. That was a descriptive claim that was dominant in many circles. I don't want to say it was everywhere in the 1990s.
Yeah,
yeah.
At one point.
Okay. Well,
John Perry Barlow.
Yeah.
Was one of
yeah. those. So it was basically Barlow. So the second claim, that was the first, that was a kind of descriptive claim about whether nations could actually regulate this stuff. Then there was a related normative claim about whether nations should be regulating it or whether the internet perhaps portended a different kind of governance. And this was Barlow's emphatic normative claim, the claim that real space governments didn't understand this new space. This new space shouldn't be infected by real space governance. This new space would be governed by, and I'm simplifying a great deal, self-governing communities who could select into these communities and have their own rules, wouldn't be tied to territory. And these communities, this was also Johnson and Post's claim, but they really drew a lot of it from Barlow. They worked it out in legal language, that these self-governing communities could come together in a way not tied by territory. And all of a sudden, it looked like the libertarians' dream, because you could have people coming together, making their own rules in communities that weren't tied to geography, and that was the basic normative claim. It was obviously more complicated than that, and we can talk about that. So the book is, in some sense, a history of why this vision didn't work out. So it starts off in the first part with the kind of an attempt to give a sympathetic reconstruction of these positive and normative claims. And then the next two parts are really explaining why it didn't work out and explaining also why even the normative vision was lacking. But the book basically makes three claims, and I'll just lay these claims out on the table and then I'm happy to talk about it. The first claim is that nations, and this is the least interesting claim for this group, that nations can, in fact, do a great deal to successfully regulate internet transactions within their borders, and that they are, in fact, doing so to the extent that they want to and are expending the resources to do so. This is not a particularly novel claim. It's basically inherent in Larry's code book, and where he pointed out that he was the first to point out in a systematic way how governments could regulate the net. This just takes it to the next step. We go into more detail about how, and this again won't be news to people in this room, about how nations can use intermediary control over financial intermediaries, ISPs, through the naming and numbering system, through search engines and the like, can use intermediaries and regulation of intermediaries to bring a great deal of control over internet transactions. Again, not perfect control, but perfect control is rarely, if ever, the goal of law, and certainly not of nations trying to control the internet. There's an interesting and hard set of questions, which we don't really answer in the book, about when and why states do better in some contexts and don't do as well in other contexts. We have a few remarks about that, but that's a really hard problem that we thought a lot about that we just really had a hard time generalizing about. But the basic claim is that states can do a lot, lot better than people thought. And China, we have a chapter on China, which is obviously the extreme case and the extreme example. So that's the first claim of the book. We worked that out in some detail. The second claim in the book is that, relatedly, the internet is becoming bordered by geography. And the bordering by geography, in other words, the internet is becoming basically balkanized in many ways. Now, part of the balkanization are these top-down, or part of the borders are these top-down pressures from states regulating and applying their different laws in their spaces within their jurisdiction. But a lot of the bordering, we claim, is coming from bottom-up pressures, from consumer demand, essentially, internet user demand. It turned out that what many people thought was the typical 1990s view was it's great that the internet is free and open and not bordered, but it turned out that different people in different places wanted different things. And this is most obviously true with respect to language. In the 1990s, you can read magazines and newspaper stories throughout the 90s where everyone thought that the internet meant that the English language was going to take over the world, and it was certainly going to dominate the internet. And that was true in the 1990s because most internet users in the 1990s were English speakers. But as the internet spread and as internet use spread, people in different places who didn't speak English started demanding content in different languages, and content providers started providing it to them in different languages. And what was true of language was true of everything else. Advertising, all sorts of information. Obviously not all information. I don't even know if it's most of the information on the net. But a great deal of the information that most people most of the time want is information about local stuff. And they want it in a language and in a form that they can understand. And we go in some detail about how these bottom-up pressures, as we call them, led to different kinds of internet experiences in different places. And one of the interesting things that it led to was some of the development of geographical identification technologies by companies like InfoSplit. What are the names of the companies? Akamai's got some. What are the other names? NetGeo and Quova, the other two. These firms, and others obviously, have developed geographical identification technology that was originally allowed. So everyone thought that the internet by its nature defied geography. This was the standard assumption in the 1990s, that you couldn't tell where anyone was in real space just by their address, and you didn't know really where in the world your messages were going, and that it was thought to be impossible to identify people by geography and to control them by geography. And this turned out not to be true. This really started in the famous Yahoo case at the turn of the century. And firms have developed remarkably sophisticated geographical identification and screening technology. And it started not because governments wanted to use it for law regulation purposes. It started because advertisers wanted to use it for advertising purposes. And in other words, the geographical technology was a response to a consumer demand for targeted information of the type I was talking about a second ago. And of course, some of the same technologies in various ways have come to be used by governments that want to screen out geographically. So anyway, the second claim of the book is that the internet's becoming bordered through a combination of these top-down government pressures and bottom-up consumer demand pressures. The third claim in the book is that this emerging bordered internet is not a terrible thing in many respects. This is probably, I guess, the most controversial claim in the book. Obviously, in most respects, it's a bad thing in China, although not in all respects. I would say the fact that most of the Chinese internet is in Chinese is a lot better for the Chinese people than if it were in English, the way it would have been in 1995. The Chinese people at least might think that the absence of serious intellectual property protections in China is a good thing for them. So in those two senses, the bordered internet or the geographically specific internet is good even for the Chinese, although it's not so good along other respects in terms of freedom of speech and the like. The basic claim that we make two basic claims about the virtues of the bordered internet and then a basic claim about the virtues of government regulation of the internet at a very high levels of abstraction. The basic claim for the virtues of a bordered internet are the same arguments for federalism, namely that you can it's really an economic argument in a way. You can maximize the preferences of people if you allow them to have law on a more local level. And the best example I can give you, and I don't know if you'll find it to be a controversial example or not, is the Yahoo case, where Yahoo basically France successfully imposed its laws within its country to prohibit Yahoo from offering Nazi goods for sale in France. And the world that has basically emerged is a world in which it's very easy. I mean, it's much more complicated than just what the French judge, Judge Gomez, did. But the world that's basically emerged is a world in which it's much harder to get, not impossible, but much harder to get Nazi goods in France than it is to get them in the United States on the internet. And why do I think that's a good thing? I think that's a good thing because, contrary to the widespread belief in the 1990s, the American First Amendment is not written into the code of the internet, and the American First Amendment does not strike the perfect balance between speech and government regulation. And France is a democracy, and they've got a different history and culture than the United States. And within, at least among democracies, our claim is that the differences in speech are legitimate differences, that it's good to let France have speech their way and for the United States to have speech its way along the dimensions that France and the United States want to have it. And a bordered internet allows that to happen. An unbordered internet doesn't. An unbordered internet means either that France gets to tell the United States what to do or the United States gets to tell France what to do, but if you can border the net off, then you can minimize that, and you can allow both to have their preferences satisfied, essentially. It's more complicated than that, and I'm happy to talk about the complications. The final point in the book, and I'll stop here, and again, this won't be surprising for this group, I hope, is that behind many successful internet communities, let me start off by saying one of the... going back to the Barlow claim that the net would allow self-governing communities to flourish independent of government. And one of our claims is that self-governing internet communities can't flourish without government, without government-sponsored public goods. And this is obviously true, I think. The example we give is eBay, where and we could talk about non-commercial communities if you wanted. The example we give is eBay. eBay is described by Thomas Friedman in The World is Flat as a self-governing nation-state constituted by its feedback system and its vigorous community norms. And he quoted Meg Whitman, eBay CEO, who said that people will say that eBay restored my faith in humanity, contrary to the world where people are cheating and don't give people the benefit of the doubt. And we have a chapter on eBay where we go through and basically document all the different ways that eBay relies on the government. And the one we focus on most is fraud control. eBay employs between 800 and 900 people whose job it is full-time, and they work hand-in-hand with very close relationships with federal and state and local prosecutors, 800 to 900 people working full-time to minimize fraud on eBay. And we basically show that without the government's assistance here, eBay would probably be overrun by fraud. Certainly its cost structure would be entirely different. It would have to spend a lot more money than it does now on preventing fraud. And so that's one way in which government provides assistance to help communities flourish. And then we just go through and talk about others, contract enforcement being one, all the services that help make the real space aspects of eBay possible. And so the basic point is a reminder of that, which should be obvious, but which sometimes gets lost in these discussions, about how important public goods are, government-sponsored public goods, to flourishing internet communities of a variety of sorts. And let me just close by saying that, so in the closing chapter, which we called Globalization Meets Government Coercion, is I think what it's called. Yeah, Globalization Meets Government Coercion. That's a bit of a dramatic, overly dramatic chapter, but title. But so the basic point is that one of the lessons of the book is that geography still matters, that where you are still matters, and where you are still matters very much, that old truths like geography matters and government matters matter even to the internet. And it seems obvious, but if you look at it from one perspective, but it hasn't been obvious to a lot of people. And that the internet, that the experiences of the last 10 years on the internet are really kind of an antidote to the breathless globalization claims that the free flow of goods and services and ideas over borders is going to homogenize everything, it's going to weaken states and the like. So we think one of the lessons of the last 10 years on the internet is that there are many forces fighting back against claims of globalization, and one way to see that is through the lens of internet regulation.
You've been listening to Harvard Law School professor Jack Goldsmith discussing a new book co-written by Columbia Law School professor Tim Wu, titled Who Controls the Internet? Illusions of a Borderless World. Audio Berkman is produced by Colin Rinesmith at the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard Law School. On the web at cyber.law.harvard.edu/audio, where you can learn more about this program, download other podcasts, and subscribe to our RSS feed. For Audio Berkman, I'm Colin Rinesmith. Thanks for listening.